Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks.
And I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're going to begin today with what we sometimes think are the facts, only to find that those facts change. When it comes to a fast-moving and emotional story like the pursuit of the Boston bombing suspects, the expression fog of war seems appropriate.
In the aftermath, as that fog lifts, some of what was first reported turns out to be wrong, or at least not precisely correct. So we're going to talk about a few examples of that from last week. And joining us now is WBUR senior reporter David Boeri. Hey, David.
Hi, Anthony.
So, first example of what we're talking about happened last Thursday night before the murder of MIT police officer Sean Collier, the carjacking, the car chase, the shootout of the two suspects. We heard about a robbery. Here's one of the first briefings by police early Friday morning.
At about 10:30 last evening, a robbery took place at a 7-Eleven in Cambridge. Subsequently, after that, an MIT police officer was shot on campus and has expired as a result of his wounds.
So, David, he's mentioning a robbery at a 7-Eleven in Cambridge, which for a while was reported as being part of this whole story.
That's right. And there was a robbery at that 7-Eleven in Cambridge. But if you looked at the store surveillance cameras, you would see that it had nothing to do with the suspects and the bombings. It was an entirely separate incident from the drama of the chase and the pursuit that followed that Thursday night.
Right. And shortly after that, police, in fact, pointed that out. Another case in point. After Zahar Tsarnaev was finally apprehended hiding in a boat in Watertown, we were told a couple of things. Among them, that he fired on police, which prompted them to fire back. Here's Boston Police Commissioner Ed Davis.
Over the course of the next hour or so, we exchanged gunfire with the suspect who was inside the boat. And ultimately, the hostage rescue team of the FBI made an entry into the boat.
So, exchange gunfire, that part of the statement now appears to be wrong.
Yes, according to Associated Press, two U.S. officials say that Zahar Tsarnaev was unarmed when the police captured him, and there was not a weapon in the boat. Now, keep in mind, there was every reason in the world to believe he was armed and dangerous. He'd been involved in a shootout the night before, and that had resulted in a lot of bloodshed and a death. It was also possible he could have been carrying a bomb, but again, according to these officials that AP quotes, Tsarnaev was unarmed when he was finally apprehended, and there was no gun in the boat.
Unarmed. Another part of the story that has changed over time had to do with where that boat in which the suspect Zahar Tsarnaev was found relative to that search area in East Watertown. Here's what Police Commissioner Ed Davis said last Friday.
We had no information that the suspect was still holed up in this particular area. He managed to elude us by being just slightly outside of the perimeter that we set up.
So just slightly outside of the perimeter in that search area in East Watertown. What do we know about that now?
Well, if this was a football game, we'd be saying, let's go to the video, because, in fact, it was inside the perimeter. Earlier this week, the Boston Police Department superintendent, William Evans, offered some new details in the manhunt for Tsarnaev, but Evans said he doesn't know who was responsible for searching the area of the boat and that he can't comment further on many of the details because they're under investigation by the FBI. But Evans said the boat was within the perimeter of the search.
I believe at this time it was inside the 20-block perimeter.
Inside 20-block perimeter, still no word why it somehow evaded the search of law enforcement officials. Okay, one more case in point, David. Last Friday, after Zahar Tsarnaev was apprehended, police said the Watertown resident David Henneberry, who owned the boat in which he was hiding, came outside, spotted blood on the boat, which prompted him to look inside and discover the suspect. But that's not what happened. Here's Henneberry setting the record straight on WCVB-TV, saying he didn't see blood or anything else until he lifted the tarp.
No indication of anything. I know people say there was blood on the boat, and he saw blood and went in. Not true. Not true.
Not true. So, David, many of these might be small and understandable mistakes. Some are bigger. My guess is there will be more facts that will sort of change. What does all this tell you about this story?
We certainly need to see what the police call after action reports on this. But the people I've talked to say that some of this stuff that we're talking about now, a lot of the confusion, the chaos, the apparent conflict with reality is not unnormal in situations like this. As one person said, you know, everybody looks one way on the day it's happening, and then the second day it all looks different. On the first day, you hear the firing, you're saying, God, that guy has a fantastic arsenal. What does he have with him? And then you realize there's no gun at all. Tom Foley, who is a colonel of the state police, has said, you know, when things are coming at you at 100 miles an hour, and that's not such a stretch from what was going on here. Mm-hmm. They're coming at you at 100 miles an hour. You have to make decisions in split seconds. And there's all this chatter. There are people on the street that are telling you things that have no connection to reality. Others who may be credible, you have to follow what they're telling you, and it doesn't pan out. All of that's going on. There's something else going on too here. Remember that it is the most junior officers, the most inexperienced officers, that are generally working at night patrol. Another thing is true that when you get outside Boston, and certainly when you're in the suburbs and elsewhere, you have a lot of police officers, and even in Boston, this is the case, who have never been fired on, who've never been in a gunfight.
I think it also points to, you know, one of the real challenges, the demands. I mean, now I'm speaking as sort of the demands on the journalists who are reporting this, of covering a kind of quickly unfolding news story in the context of this 24-hour on all the time news industry.
Yeah, no surprise to you. The police like us after they leave the job when they're in a bar, you know, and you buy them a beer. But they don't particularly like us when we're on the job and they're on the job, because we make their lives more difficult. And you always hear the frustration of people trying to break news and then getting them more of a jam, because there's another element to all this. It never gets far away, and especially in Boston, it never gets far away, which is politics. Mm-hmm. I mean, you had a force of something like 4,000 police officers last week, and I think you could, you know, they achieved the goal, but I think what you got to remember is, in a lot of ways, it was like a UN peacekeeping force. Lots of jurisdictions, people who get their noses bent out of shape, they don't always play together well, and that's going on too.
Mm. WBUR senior reporter David Boeri, thanks so much. We appreciate it.
You're welcome.
Now, the final authoritative reckoning of all that happened last week is a long way off yet. However, last night, we heard one of the most riveting and compelling first-person accounts of the Boston Marathon bombings.
I heard one of my sergeants, and I couldn't understand a word he said. And this is a guy I've been in the trenches with, I've been through a number of doors with. This is one of our top level-headed street bosses.
Was this on your radio, Chief?
Yes.
Yeah.
And there was so much noise and so much confusion. I didn't know what Danny had, but I know that Danny Keelan needed me on Boylston Street.
Daniel Linsky is the superintendent-in-chief for the Boston Police Department. He was one of several guests at a special WBUR event last night called Boston After the Bombings, a public conversation of hope and healing, hosted by On Point's Tom Ashbrook.
Superintendent Linsky writes and implements the security plan for the Boston Marathon. After Monday's attacks, he supervised the Boston Police Department's investigation and search for the two men who would later be identified as Tamerlan and Zahar Tsarnaev.
At the WBUR event last night, Linsky began by telling Tom and the live audience what he did in the seconds after he first heard about the explosions at the finish line on Monday.
So I ran over the bridge into Kenmore Square. By that time, one of my deputy superintendents was there, and they'd received a phone call that there was some type of explosion at the finish line. Commandeered his vehicle with him. We drove down, and I was praying that we had an electrical explosion.
Yeah.
That a natural disaster had hit our city, and as they were telling me, we had horrific amputations and injuries, that At least it's not terror. When I turned onto the street, I got out and I got briefed, and Danny told me, they hit us twice, boss. Once here and then a second blast as people ran towards it. And my first instinct as Danny Linsky's father and as a cop was to get in and start applying pressure. And I couldn't do that because I was in charge. And I needed to make sure that everyone else could do their jobs. When this happens, you'll have 400 or 500 responders come up, and if somebody doesn't get control of it and have them control their vehicles, they jump out of their car, they take their keys, they rush in to help, and then the street's blocked.
Yeah.
But Danny Keela got on the radio and very calmly and very assertively told everyone coming in, do not block this street. And I did what I had to do, and I realized that we had been attacked, and I realized that our intelligence tells us that they're probably going to target first responders. So I put on the radio that I believe we have additional IEDs and units should respond appropriately. And there were several packages, and people were screaming about this suspicious package and that suspicious package.
And who knew?
And we just said, okay, let's get the victims out. Then we had to deal with the people who had sheltered in place. And our intention was to keep them sheltered in place, triage and transport the victims, clear out any IEDs, and then figure out what we got and start working this crime scene. So that's what we did. And we ran out of ambulances, and one of my deputy superintendents, Colm Lydon, started grabbing police wagons, which is not the best solution to transport a patient. But if you've got nothing else and you throw two talented medics and doctors
better than nothing.
Doctors like that hero who ran from her marathon finish, in that they could save those patients. And they did. I think the timeline, I might have it wrong, but I think within 22 minutes, all those patients were at the hospital.
Chief Linsky, there's the blast, and there they go. People running to help. They go to the hospitals. You're corralling your forces. You're responding to that. At a certain point, it has to turn from, oh, my God, look at what's happened here. Let's deal with this, to who did this and how do we begin? When did that point come? And how does that thought process begin?
The point came to me as soon as we got the victims loaded up in the last truck out of there. And then I wanted to get my cops out of there so they could be safe from what I thought might be extra bombs. And then Sergeant Detective Keela immediately grabbed his troops and sent them into some of the restaurants and started pulling videotape. And the commissioner and Kurt Schwartz and the state police assets that were there decided we were going to go to the Westin Hotel and set up a command post. At the same time, the FBI is coming in. The commissioner contacted Rich DeLaurier. And our members of the Joint Terrorism Task Force get with them, and we start an investigation. We start locking up a crime scene. We start clearing potential EOD devices. We start running down leads. We start pulling video.
Pulling video from establishments around the area, including Lord & Taylor.
Yeah, the press had that wrong. It was never Lord & Taylor.
Oh. The press had something wrong?
They started pulling video, and we started looking at where we needed to go with this and how we needed to protect the city.
You're listening to Boston Police Chief Superintendent Daniel Linsky. He led the Boston Police Department's investigation of the marathon bombings, and he spoke last night at a WBUR special event with On Point's Tom Ashbrook.
After the initial bombings, days passed before investigators released pictures of two suspects who were later identified as Tamerlan and Jahar Tsarnaev. That happened on Thursday at 5 p.m., Linsky described to Tom last night what happened just a few hours later that led to a tense 24-hour manhunt and regional lockdown.
Were authorities justified in shutting down the whole city? Governor Patrick's request for people to shelter in place, to stay behind locked doors, to only open for a uniformed officer, for businesses to close, for the trains to come down, for the public transit to come down, was that justified looking back on it?
Based on the information we had, the situation we had in emerging, the phone call I made to my mother and my children and my wife were, stay inside your home. I can tell you I would not have done that if I did not think it was a threat.
But why? There won't be a terrorist on every street. There was an enormous area that was locked down, became the phrase of the day.
Yeah. And we had an enormous number of things that we were dealing with and information that we were sorting out and challenges and threats that we had to mitigate. before we can ensure the safety of the individuals in the area.
Take us to the end of the capture story. You were in Watertown.
Let me be clear. The governor and the mayor made the right call.
Chief Linsky, overnight then, when we saw the tremendous firefight in Watertown, that was a huge number of rounds. What was happening there? Well, I mean, I'm a radio guy. I've heard the tape. Even TV, it's pitch black. And I still don't completely understand what was happening that brought about that huge exchange of gunfire.
Which exchange?
Well, the exchange in which...
I don't mean to be funny. There was an exchange of gunfire
in Watertown in which the first suspect, Tamerlan, died. The first brother died.
So they had murdered the police officer and they had hijacked a car, not in Cambridge but in Alston.
Yeah.
They had made statements to that driver, and we realized that our bombers were on the run and were operational, and we were trying to catch them. Watertown did a great job of identifying them, and I was in the middle of a car chase when I heard my officers saying that they were shooting and bombs were going off. And I was at the corner of Mount Auburn and Sump Street. I didn't know where it was, but we were standing with about 30 officers behind cover on one building and 20 or 30 on another building. And we were there had been items and potentially a suspect around the corner, so people were trying to stay out of the line of fire when I heard Ricky Moriarty, one of my gang officers, screaming for help. Ricky's another Marine Corps veteran who was very battle-tested, and I knew that he was in trouble. And he was screaming that he had an officer who was hit, and he needed assistance right away. He needed an ambulance. And I kept asking two or three times, "Ricky, please let me know where you are. Let me know where you are." And I finally heard him say 144 Dexter Street. I don't know Watertown. I didn't know where I was. There was a state trooper there, and I looked at him, and he looked at me, and I said, "Where are we?" And he said, "I don't know." We looked over our shoulders simultaneously, and I saw a sign that said Dexter Street. And I couldn't see around the curb, but I knew that Ricky Moriarty was down that street with the police officer. And we knew that there potentially was a suspect. And the trooper and I looked at each other and said, "Let's go." We ran down to get Ricky. And all the officers followed us once they knew where to go.
Yeah.
And I got down to Ricky, and he was holding pressure with some other officers, and we were begging for an ambulance. And the other officers were elevating the leg and doing what they had to do, and I looked over, and I saw one of my gang officers who had a subject in custody.
So he had already taken the bullet high in the leg that led to all that loss of blood that threatened his life. The suspect was down already at this point?
The suspect was down at that point. And I ran over because I was afraid that the individual would have an IED vest on and was going to blow up my officer. So I said, "Jared, be careful. He might be loaded." And we began to strip his clothes off to make sure that he didn't have bombs anymore. And by then we got an ambulance for the officer. And then we began calling for an ambulance for the suspect. Because that's what we do. Because we're better than them. And we gave him medical care and tried to save his life, even though he killed children and women in our city, and even though he tried to kill us.
Had he already been run over by the SUV? This is the report that we've heard.
Yes, he had.
By Jokar, escaping Tamerlane, was run over at this point already?
That's correct. By the time I got there, that firefight had ended and he had already been run over. And he was transported out, and we realized we had unexploded bombs around us. And we went back up and tried to make the best we could of a scene. Again, we had to protect the scene, and we had to figure out how to get rid of the IEDs. These ones were not backpacks that were dropped by runners. These were improvised explosive devices designed to kill us. And we had to catch him. The commissioner got together with the chief of Watertown, State Police, John Foley from the FBI. They determined they wanted to try and get a perimeter around where he bailed out. And we needed to get people back to the Arsenal Mall so we could start doing it right.
Yeah.
And they got everyone back. They told me what they wanted to do. And I was very fortunate that the men and women who showed up at that scene are men and women I've gone through doors with as a narcotics officer and run events with as a police commander. And we were all known to each other and knew how we worked and all knew what the mission was. So they asked me to get it done, and I worked with my partners from all those federal agencies, and we set up a perimeter. We set up 5 quadrants. We sent in 5 tactical teams. We sent in 5 tactical support teams. And we began a search. And we searched, and we searched, and we searched, and we searched. Everyone there. They were National Guard troops. They show up and say, "What can we do for you, Chief?" I said, "If you got Humvees, I'll take them. And what do you got for troops?" "I got a bunch of guys, but none of us have weapons, but we're ready to go." And those kids deployed out with my cops without any weapons on.
Wow. After all that gunfire.
And they stood their posts all day, and we hunted and we hunted. And you cannot believe, and someday you'll probably find out, the amount of information that flowed in that was damaging, and the amount of information that flowed out that we were able to determine was no longer a problem.
And the highs and lows. Damaging. What do you mean by that, Chief?
I'll talk about that another time later on. There's stuff that went on that we had to deal with and vet and look to see what the threats were and eliminate threats. And there were times when we thought we had them over and over again, and your adrenaline was cursing and pulsing through your veins, and then it was a letdown and another letdown and another letdown. It was someone who, in the middle of all of this, texted their daughter that they were being held hostage by a man with a gun in the middle of the crime scene. We raced to that house frig and we had him cornered. We did our thing and we cleared the house. We find out that somebody had psychological issues and wanted to be in the spotlight that day and wasted our resources and wasted our time. At the end of it, there was a SWAT commander for the Boston Police Department and a SWAT team for the Boston Police Department and Superintendent Billy Evans and the men and women who were assigned to his command who wanted to continue searching, and they needed a couple more minutes. And there was some confusion in the communication, and they continued searching anyways. And others had worked since dawn to dusk, had started home, figuring we're going to have to go at this another way and find him, that he must have gotten out of the neighborhood. And then the call came in. By the way, I should tell you, at this point, the commissioner had relieved me of duty because I had done 40 hours, and I could no longer stand. And that was the right decision. I left the command post, and Ed Kelly, the president of the Firefighters Union, who's a friend of mine, said, "You're not driving your car, are you?" And I said, "No, you are."
That's what friends are for.
And Eddie drove me home, and he and my wife put me on the couch, and I opened a beer, and I was trying to figure out what we could do to get him the next day, what other investigative leads our detectives could work on. And then I got alerted to what was going on in the boat.
In the boat, where he was found, where he was taken. You know, you say there's more that we'll learn at another time, and we look forward to that. I want to ask you this, because we could talk all night about these details. I'm sure everybody in this hall feels the same way. I'm riveted by this. But the vice president was in town today, and he, like the president before him, like the mayor, like the governor, like everybody in this room, says we'll be back next year bigger than ever with the Boston Marathon. How do we do that, Chief, and guard against this happening again without fundamentally changing the nature of that day of civic activity? Can it be done?
We do that by engaging every one of the Boston community. So I had 800 police officers with their eyes on that route looking to protect people. There are probably 1 million people who come out. Seems to me that's 2 million more eyes than I had last year. And if we all work together and we say something and we keep an eye out for each other and we protect each other, we're going to fill that route next year.
Thank you.
Chief Superintendent Daniel Linsky of the Boston Police Department. He spoke last night at a WBUR special event called Boston After the Bombings, a public conversation of hope and healing.
And stay with us. There's a lot more ahead still to come. I'm Anthony Brooks.
And I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.